Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. What has happened to the media? As more and more magazines follow newspapers to extinction, TV networks fill their schedules with cheap and easy reality shows, and radio stations compete ever less robustly with iPods and online streaming, one would imagine the people in charge at those institutions would be doing whatever they could to understand the forces chipping away at their audience and their revenues. But as media critic and On the Media co-host Bob Garfield sees it, many of those executives seem to be engaging in a kind of extended denial about the imminent demise of their industries as they have existed in the past. And while Garfield is convinced a renaissance is on the horizon, he is not convinced advertisers and the media outlets that serve them really understand how to capitalize on it. Bob Garfield's new book on the subject is called The Chaos Scenario. Amid the ruins of mass media, the choice for business is stark. Listen or perish. Bob, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
Start, if you will, by describing the chaos unleashed on traditional media and advertisers by the rise of what, at least for the time being, we still call new media.
Well, I'd be happy to, but first, if I may, let me just give you a little context. And the context is, for the last 350 years, we have lived in the most marvelous circumstances. Mass media has been underwritten by mass advertising since the Elizabethan era. And it's worked out great for everybody. We've gotten free episodes of the Beverly Hillbillies and very inexpensive newspapers. I mean, I promise you it costs more than whatever, 50 cents for the Dallas Morning News per copy to make. But advertising has underwritten that since the entire history of that paper. And, of course, marketers have gotten access to the very mass audience attracted by this high-quality, highly produced content. In fact, Chris, I think most of us think it's sort of like our birthright, that it's a law of the universe, like the laws of physics, or that it's somehow etched in the Ten Commandments, thou shalt have free or subsidized media. But it isn't. I mean, I got to tell you, I've pored over the Ten Commandments. It's not there. And it's going away. That is the fundamental problem. The mass media and mass marketing are decoupling, never to be joined again. And the consequence is that we are going to lose some of these things that we have considered a given, including high-quality daily newspapers and high-quality, highly produced dramas and sitcoms. And what we're going to be left with is, at least for a long, long time, is something far less. And it's all because, as you alluded to earlier, it's all because of the internet, the digital revolution, that this has taken place.
Yeah, because this has essentially destroyed the economics of scarcity. There is no longer any limit whatsoever to the real estate available for putting out content.
I'm like, duh, that is so exactly the point. Economics, of course, are all about scarcity. And what we have here, I mean, there's several problems afflicting the media right now. One of them is simply ad avoidance. People who have the option of avoiding a TV commercial with their DVRs do, or at least 70% of them do. People have spam filters, and nobody has ever clicked on a banner ad ever. I mean, people, and Madison Avenue likes to think they are beloved, but they're not beloved. They're sort of the quid pro quo that we have grudgingly accepted over the last 350 years for this cheap, high-quality content. So there's ad avoidance. That's one big problem. Fragmentation is another big problem. Because of the internet and other digital technologies, there are just... the mass audiences are fewer and farther between. And they are what the networks, for example, are losing is the critical mass to generate enough ad revenue to subsidize, to pay for the production of, let's say, new episodes of Lost. And that's why we have, 5 days a week of Jay Leno in prime time, and I think it's now 11 days of The Biggest Loser. So it's that cheap programming is there not because we love it, but because the networks can't afford to give us what we really do love.
Well,
and then there is the supply and demand. I mean, that's the big thing. There is a glut online. There is an almost infinite supply of content, and therefore an almost infinite supply of advertising inventory. And in an ultra super hyper glut, prices are going to be driven down, down, down. So now all publishers and broadcasters everywhere are getting less in advertising revenue for smaller audiences. A small number times a small number equals not enough to give us what we've always desired.
Well, and the vast majority of that online content now is still being delivered free of charge to users. And at the beginning, I guess, providers of this content assumed that they would generate all the revenue they needed through ad sales. They thought to themselves, in fact, oh, great, we can add to what we're getting from our traditional resources by also selling these online ads. And it turns out that has never worked.
No, mainly because the prices that you fetch for online ads are very, very low. And the other problem is, of course, that to the extent that you are putting your content online for free or with a little bit of advertising support, you're cannibalizing your principal marketplace, which is broadcast. And, you know, it's not a one-for-one trade-off. You don't for every viewer you lose to the Internet and to piracy, I might add, you do not you get the same amount of revenue that you lost when they fled broadcast. And that's not going to get better. It's going to get worse. Now, ultra-targeting, which is one of the technologies that the Internet does offer, will enable you to get to charge more for customers than you did on broadcast in theory. But it will not that premium that you get for hyper-targeting will not exceed what you're losing because of the supply glut. So it's a less than zero sum game. It's a negative sum game, and that is unfortunately the road to catastrophe.
Well, and it's not only old media properties that are struggling, despite producing content that people really want. Talk for a minute about YouTube, which has been serving up hundreds of millions of hits a day since 2006, and as I understand it, has yet to report a single quarter in the black.
And it's a long time before that quarter is going to come. I mean, first of all, Google paid $1.65 billion for YouTube. And it's no wonder. I mean, they've got like 75-80% of the online video market, and they have changed human behavior on a grand scale, and it's almost single-handedly destroyed the TV business. So it's clearly a force to be reckoned with. But you can't sell ads against it for a whole variety of reasons. One is that a lot of the content is sketchy, and advertisers are, you know, they're pretty terrified about having their ads appear next to sketchy content. Another problem is that it's annoying to be interrupted by an ad. A lot of the people who go onto YouTube just don't want it to be contaminated by advertising, and the moment they see any hint of advertising, they flee because, once again, people given the opportunity to avoid advertising will. And, you know, their bandwidth is, last year was probably in the order of $700 million. $700 million is their phone bill, basically. Now, the cost of bandwidth is going down, 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 but it'll be a long time before they pay less in their phone bill than they're generating in ad revenue, and most likely never. So that is a tough row to hoe. And YouTube's problems are sort of quintessential. Online is great, and it's the greatest trove of content that has ever existed, and its utility is undeniable, and it is revolutionizing the world in so many marvelous ways. But there's no business model. You know, there's just no way to extract money from people's wallets because they're accustomed to getting all that stuff for free.
So
and,
I know
that problem doesn't seem to have a ready solution.
I know that YouTube has been talking about putting movies up on the site that people could pay for and different things. How can they convince users on a broad scale, though, to start paying for that content that they have been so happily sampling for free all this time, much of which, honestly, if they had to pay for it, they probably wouldn't?
Some people have the willingness to pay is not an absolute. I mean, for example, people spend a fortune to get HBO and Showtime and so forth. And, there is a percentage of the population that is willing to pony up for the content they value. But most of us go the other way. We have particularly people under 30 believe that all content wants to be free. Now, they believe that because, as a practical matter for them, content has been free. And they think that's their birthright. Now, you know, I think the idea that someone else's intellectual property does not belong to them, I think, is ethically bankrupt. But that moral high ground doesn't do you any good if you're a content provider. If the audience demands things for free, one, they'll steal it. That's what piracy is all about. And number two, they're certainly not going to give you their credit card number because they have come to expect that they have to pay nothing. And furthermore, the content providers have simply ingrained that idea by giving the stuff away for free for the last dozen years. Look at newspapers, for heaven's sake. I mean, they're trying desperately to put the genie back in the bottle, but people think that online newspaper content is free, and good luck to the New York Times and others trying to get people to shell out for it.
Well, yeah, I'm sure you remember this, too. A decade or so ago, every media institution was grappling with the question of how much to give for free. And at first, there were really limited amounts of content, and everybody was afraid that if you put something on the website, that people wouldn't watch the 6 o'clock news or the 10 o'clock news. Did they err in judgment? Was there one force that caused everybody else to assume that it had to be free?
Yeah, it was amazing. It was 500 different media properties all making the same strategic blunder. And the blunder was simple. They had been they had never been in the content business. They'd always been in the audience selling business. I mean, that's what broadcasters and newspapers do. You know, their product is nominally news and entertainment, but their business is selling audience to advertisers. And they made a decision, 10, 12 years ago, that their play was an advertising play. And to the extent that they could increase their audience, they would generate more advertising revenue. And so they took down paywalls and they gave everything away for free on the theory that they'd have so much traffic that they could underwrite the cost of everything. Well, that would have been a very good strategy had they been able to sell advertising against that traffic. But they can't because, for one thing, a lot of the traffic has nothing. You know, the New York Times has, 50, 100 times more traffic online than it ever had readers for its print edition. But a lot of it, that audience is in Europe, Asia, Africa, South America. And, they don't shop at Bloomie's. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is the supply and demand problem. It never occurred to anybody that they wouldn't be able to fetch much for what they call CBMs. CPMs are cost per thousand. And the CPMs online, what advertisers pay for 1,000 sets of eyeballs, is much, much, much lower than what they paid for the same sets of eyeballs in the print editions. And that has stymied everybody. And now they're trying to change the model, and it's probably too late.
Well, and the Times has just given up on Times Select, which was the special columns and things that people would have to pay for. What do you think went into their decision to go ahead and give it away, even though they had been generating at least some revenue from all that?
Again, it was depressing their traffic. And they said, oh, my goodness, it's depressing our traffic. We can't do this. We can't do this. We sell advertising against that traffic. But they can't get much for that advertising, so they made the wrong call.
Bob Garfield is with us. He is a media critic and co-host of NPR's On the Media. His new book is called The Chaos Scenario. Amid the ruins of mass media, the choice for business is stark. Listen or perish. We will talk about what is important in that listening in just a moment. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is media critic Bob Garfield. He is also co-host of NPR's On the Media. His new book is called The Chaos Scenario. Amid the ruins of mass media, the choice for business is stark. Listen or perish. So, Bob, you write here about something that you call listenomics, which essentially is the idea that marketers need to start listening back to consumers because consumers have essentially stopped listening to them.
I'm going to answer that question just as soon as I remark about hearing my own voice in the promo for On the Media. That was a genuinely creepy experience, although that man sounded so charming. That show sounds so fascinating.
You're going to have to tune in.
I'm going to tune in to that On the Media. Yeah, listenomics. Listenomics is the art and science of shutting up and paying attention to what the world at large has to say. You know, in the brave new world, we are all connected, and we can all, instead of being mute, the mute hoi polloi, listening to the dictates of the man, we can now talk amongst ourselves about the man. And, you know, sometimes we don't have the nicest things to say. So in the first instance, all institutions, whether it be KERA or Comcast or the U.S. government or Procter & Gamble, has to be listening very carefully to what its many, many, many customers and other stakeholders out there are saying, because, for one thing, a mob can form. If you're not doing what your job right, if you're annoying the people who are not, you know, the group formerly known as the audience, they take it personally. They tend to gang up against you and make your life a living hell. That's what Comcast learned when they made the mistake of annoying me.
Don't mess with Bob Garfield.
Coalesce a mob and started a website called Comcast Must Die. Not with the aim to killing the corporation, but with the aim to forcing it, extorting it, blogmailing it into paying attention to its customers' service problems. And they were reduced to going onto a website called Comcast Must Die, monitoring it 24 hours a day, to respond to the people whom they'd ignored through their own customer service apparatus, such that it is. And so in the first instance, you don't want to be in the position of having to suppress a mob. But the other thing about listenomics is, in a connected world, all institutions suddenly have access to the aggregated knowledge, ideas, energies, passions, loyalties, evangelism of pretty much the whole world. And if you're clever about tapping into that, of exploiting it, never mind your in-house consultants and all your high-priced talent, there is just much, much more cumulative IQ and energy out there in the world than you've ever had access to before in all of industrial history. So, you're just a fool if you don't take advantage. And that's what listenomics is all about, figuring out how to take advantage of the connected world.
And one company that did this brilliantly was one that seems as low-tech as you could possibly get, and that's Lego.
Yeah, this is such a wonderful story. Lego sells colorful plastic bricks. If you're a parent at one time or another, you've
owned 9,000 of them.
Gone to the bathroom at 3 o'clock in the morning and, you know, found one impaled in the sole of your foot. Am I correct?
Yeah, more than once.
Yeah. So everybody around the world knows Lego. In fact, it's the most popular toy ever created in the history of the world. But, it's hard when you're Lego to compete in a 21st century World of Warcraft world. And so in a desperate attempt to kind of catch up to the technology, to technological play, let me try that again, to technological play, they invented a line of products called Mindstorms, and it was aimed at like 12-year-old boys. And you could build your own robot and program it using Lego stuff. But it didn't catch on that much with 12-year-old boys because it was kind of complicated, and it was certainly far more complicated than just building stuff with bricks. But it did find an audience among these like older adult geekazoids who became obsessed with these Mindstorms robots and built these social networks, chat rooms, and listservs, and exchanged all sorts of information about these Mindstorms robots. So when Lego went back to relaunch the line after about 3 or 4 years, instead of doing everything in-house, they brought in these very users. They called it the Mindstorms Users Group. They invited them to the headquarters in Billund, Denmark, a place where I guarantee you do not want to visit. and these people flew in at their own expense from, you know, everywhere around the world and worked in-house with Lego's own design team and essentially created the new line of Mindstorms. And then when they were done after some weeks of collaboration in-house and another 13 months or so online, they were equally energetic in becoming the de facto marketing program for Mindstorms, because 100% of Mindstorms marketing is done on those very same chat rooms and websites and listservs and blogs where these people had, you know, that they had haunted beforehand. And long story short, Mindstorms became the most profitable line in the history of Lego. And they never took out a single ad anywhere because they trusted their own audience to understand the product better than they did. And there's a lesson in there for not just other manufacturers, but all institutions, including the United States government.
Let's go first to Brett in Louisville. Hey, Brett.
Hey. I just wanted to make a comment. You know, I am a sustaining member of KERA. Thank you guys for what you could do. I'm curious what you think about the future potential business model of that. I was drawn to KERA because of just quite frankly empty content out there. I mean, I'm not a news junkie, but I'm more of an information junkie, and I just found that they just kind of divided themselves into more entertainment propaganda and really junk news. And then I found KERA, which I believe is real news. I'm just curious how you feel about those things and what you think about that that business model.
Thanks for your call. And for the record, Brett is not a blood relative of mine anyway.
Well, that is a very trenchant question because you're right. KERA and NPR, the rest of public broadcasting, is the antidote for what's called cable news, what's incorrectly called cable news. But the good news is that the programming is fantastic. The bad news is that public radio is no less challenged by the forces of chaos than anybody else. It is because, you know, fundamentally, as broadband penetration gets closer and closer to universal, the idea of transmitting radio waves through the air with, you know, giant high-powered transmitters and antennas is on the verge of being preposterous, when NPR could, with the flip of a switch or a click of a mouse, send the same programming to you directly and take their money directly from you. I mean, this fundamental problem that the distribution system for public radio is obsolete has the entire public broadcasting system crazy right now. The stations are out of their minds for fear that the networks are going to usurp. The network, PBS and NPR, are going to usurp them. And the NPR is out of its mind with worry that the money's going to stop coming in because the money is provided for the most part by the individual stations. And, you know, they're at an impasse. So the business model clearly does not work. Something has to give. And nobody is sure precisely what. But I can tell you this. The survival of KERA and every other public radio station in the country will directly flow from its ability to be the cultural news, information, entertainment hub of its community. And if KERA does not become that, and by the way, it is now in competition with the Dallas Morning News and every local TV station and maybe parties yet unheard from, if it doesn't win that, what we will see to be a gigantic land grab in every community in the country, you know, it's going to go the way of all things. So it behooves the station to understand that it is not a radio station anymore, but it must serve all of the news, culture, and information needs of its entire audience in every platform, radio, video, and text, and beat the others to it. The good news for radio is, public radio is, that their income flow for the moment is not jeopardized because people who will not pay for the New York Times will pay for their KERA, which is kind of ironic because people are loath to pay for the things that they're supposed to pay for and yet write checks to public radio even though they can get it for free.
Well, 10% of them do.
Yes, well, God bless that percentage because that's what keeps us all, that's what keeps our mortgage payments, up to date. So we'll see. I'm certainly hoping for the best because I, have a lot of unfunded tuition liability in my life.
Can you talk for a minute, Bob, about this little technology of widgets and how that works? Because they can work, but some marketers are really reluctant to go into these whole hog.
Yeah, widgets are just apps. There's many transportable software apps, not unlike the apps that you might download to your iPhone or something like that. Sometimes they're just entertainment. They're goofy things that games or movie trailers or whatever. And sometimes they're very utilitarian, kind of the way that advertising specialties, the fly swatter that has that has the hardware store's name emblazoned on it, or the foam beer can cooler that has the name of the beer distributor. They're inexpensive to make. And they reside either in perpetuity or at least for a limited time on your desktop, on your Facebook page, or wherever. And your friends, when they see them, can grab them and take them to their own Facebook page so they're potentially viral. And while they're there, they are either entertaining or useful and certainly remind you every time you look at them, every time you use them, of the marketer who has given it to you free of charge. And in a world where advertising is going to be less and less and less part of the landscape, widgets are a fantastic kind of, at minimum, a Band-Aid for what is going to be lost with the death of advertising. And at best, the core of an ongoing relationship between marketers and individuals. If I've got that Southwest Air ding widget on my desktop and I've put in the Albuquerque to Denver route and there's a special that Southwest is running Albuquerque to Denver and it goes ding, that's done me a favor. I get the cheap route, Southwest gets a customer, and not only that, they get a whole lot of data from me. Everyone is served. It's a win-win-win. I just don't see what's wrong with that.
Well, and you write here that there could be a huge value to selling this, what is called metadata, which is essentially everybody's demographics plugged into the kinds of things that they have purchased and the sorts of interactions that they have made. There's a lot of information being collected about us right now. What's being done with it?
Well, for the most part, nothing harmful to you personally. There, needless to say, when so much data about you is floating around in so many places, it can make you uneasy. And especially in the last day or two when you find out that various fishing expeditions, that's P-H-I-S-H-I-N-G, fishing expeditions have compromised the security of Hotmail addresses and I think some Gmail addresses. We're all a nervous wreck about identity theft and just personal information about us, banking and medical information, getting out to third parties. And the whole idea of the internet that makes it so valuable to marketers and other institutions is that this data is there and we can learn so much more about our customers and our stakeholders. But of course, that makes everybody queasy because how much do you want Charmin to know about you personally? Well, there's two things about that. One is they don't know anything about you personally. They know something about your browser address and maybe your IP address. But they don't know anything about you, Chris. So that's one thing. The second thing is, privacy, in my view, is not an absolute. Every day, we view privacy as a commodity. Travelers sacrifice some degree of privacy for security in travel. Celebrities sacrifice some degree of privacy for their celebrity. And you and I both sacrifice some degree of our privacy when we go to the checkout aisle and get cents off on our grocery purchase and yet are reporting exactly how much Preparation H we're buying and in what size tubes. Now, it's a decision we have made that there is a value to selling off bits of our privacy for things that we value. And most of the data that is floating out there about us comes back to benefit us. I mean, it seems to me that if advertisers are not know enough about me to advertise stuff to me that may seem more relevant, I am spared having a lot of stuff inundate me that isn't relevant. Should I be concerned that they know enough about me not to send me the information on, yeast infections? Well, I'm pretty happy not being bothered about stuff that I'm not in the market for. And they don't know anything about me, Bob. They're not delving into my inner life. And so I'm cool with that.
Well,
others, of course, are not so sanguine.
You don't really have much of a choice. If you're going to interact online, you almost can't get around without cookies.
You can't, but, well, you can. I mean, if you're assiduous in avoiding being tracked, you can make it your business not to accept cookies. And it really impedes your progress around the net, and it impedes the utility of a lot of stuff you do online. But, you know, if you want to live in a bubble, you can. My point of view is that you're the loser.
Back in just a minute with Bob Garfield, co-host of NPR's On the Media and the author of a new book called The Chaos Scenario. Amid the ruins of mass media, the choice for business is stark, listen or perish.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Bob Garfield. He is co-host of NPR's On the Media and the author of a new book called The Chaos Scenario. Amid the ruins of mass media, the choice for business is stark, listen or perish. Our email address is think@kera.org, and that's where Dave writes, "I'm sorry, you guys sound like crybabies. You describe reality, then complain that you can't make a profit from that reality." What do you think about that, Bob?
I don't understand. I mean, I just don't. Am I a crybaby? Yeah, I am crying for the loss of something that we have all cherished for going on four centuries. It's tragic that we are going to lose this fantastic accident of history that has created the symbiosis between mass media and mass marketing. It has been pretty fabulous for everybody, and that's going away. So, by the way, you know, it's many, many thousands, if not millions, of lives are going to be affected. Livelihoods are going to be lost. There's going to be blood in the streets. It's going to be an economic dislocation, the likes of which we haven't seen since the Industrial Revolution. So, yeah, I'm crying about that. On the other hand, I'm pretty optimistic that after a lot of shakeout, that the online world is going to reproduce some of what we've lost, and then compensate us in ways that, you know, maybe not even thought of now, because the internet revolution has been genuinely revolutionary, from, you know, the easy pass to the digital revolution, I should say, from the easy pass to YouTube to all sorts of ways to transmit medical information to genuinely democratic conversation going on in places where hitherto no such thing had taken place. So the internet is fantastic, but it's going to take its toll.
You know, what's interesting, Bob, is that we've talked about media outlets and content producers and advertisers sort of having their heads in the sand for some time over this. But we haven't talked much about the fact that, these consumers who say, I don't pay for anything. I shouldn't have to pay for anything. My time is worth more than my money. They, too, potentially are looking at a future where the content is not as robust and, not as well developed as that which was supported previously by ad dollars.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not that it's their fault. It's not like shame on you for shame on you for downloading music that you haven't paid for. But, I mean, this is a gigantic structural problem that has to do with technology affecting economies on a grand scale. And, you know, I'm not going to blame listeners for the circumstances we are all in. But, you know, the fact remains we are not going to have a robust newspaper business for any time in the foreseeable future. I mean, I guess your listeners are aware of how desperate the situation is in Dallas. I don't know what's going on in the rest of your listener area, but it's worse elsewhere around the country. I mean, newspapers are dropping left, right, and center, and it's, you know, it's pretty tragic in the communities which used to have high-quality, robust journalism, in fact, journalistic competition, now they're left with next to nothing. And I don't see how that benefits anybody.
Let's go next on the phone to Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. I wanted to make a couple quick comments, and then I'm going to ask my question. I wanted to react to, I want to address those folks who are driving down the road right now listening to this broadcast. If you've never given a dime to this station, all you got to do is go to npr.org and prepare to be shocked at this amazing resource. It's the reason that really tipped me over the edge. Go to npr.org and take a look. And the second comment is, I want to say that, Mr. Garfield, you are doing God's work on that show. But, you know, shows like you and The Daily Show that are really working to unravel lies and tell the truth as best as you understand it. And I wanted to compliment you on doing that. And my question is related to that. In the coarsening of the discourse, which is we've descended into this Lee Atwater, Karl Rove hell, apparently, it costs money to undo and unravel lies. Has this contributed to its abilities for newspapers to do business? Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, well, there's a lot I'd like to comment on. First of all, thank you. You're very kind to say. I'm sure NPR and KERA thank you as well. I'm glad you lumped us in with The Daily Show. That's company I'd like to be lumped in with. I regret to say that as earnest as we are at On the Media in our mission to bring clarity to the confusing world of media and government information, that they do it just so much better. And we are constantly frustrated by just how they are vastly more, I don't know, succinct and entertaining than we are. Of course, they get to lie and kid and, you know, make fun, and we have to play it pretty straight. But nonetheless, we admire them a great deal. The answer to your last question is no. There are separate issues. There is the economic issue of the collapse of media due to the digital revolution. And then there's the other issue of the corruption of the public discourse, substantially, although not entirely, due to the kind of Rovian tactics of the right and, you know, some level of that from the left as well. I mean, it's ugly out there. Cable news is just a cesspool. And political debate is the nicest thing I can say about it in this day and age is that it's a caricature, and it's ugly and it's embarrassing and it's a stain on democracy, but it pretty much has nothing to do with what I'm writing about in the chaos scenario. In fact, maybe the only good thing about the destruction of the media as we know it is that, you know, cable news will probably be one of the victims, and that'll be a victory for everybody.
We have an email here from Gabriel who wants to know what you think about Hulu and the way it is doing business. He says, I don't mind watching a show, watching a minute and a half to 2 minutes of commercials before my show starts. Then I get the rest of it without interruption, and I get to watch it at a time that suits me.
Yeah, Hulu is kind of cool. This was a joint venture by a number of the big broadcast companies. I think it's Viacom, NBC, and Fox. I think those are the big three players. And they put their stuff up in a convenient form online, and you can watch it online, or you can, you know, have it plugged into your actual TV machine. And you can get to see all the shows that you might otherwise have watched on your cable or direct or your satellite TV or over broadcast. And there are fewer commercial interruptions. And they thought that's a way to coalesce the very fragmented audience that has fled broadcast and cable TV and gone online. Yeah, well, it's a pretty good service. And at least they're able to get some money from their audience in terms of in the form of advertising revenue that they've lost from having them flee the regular venue of broadcast and cable TV. But they don't get much. And, you know, I think Hulu is going to be rendered pretty much obsolete anyway by a phenomenon known as over-the-top. And that's very simple. Over-the-top means that the cable companies that have been stringing the coax into your homes for the last 50 years and have been screwing you every month in those gigantic bills, you can now go online to Hulu and elsewhere and get free or with very little advertising the very programming that you're paying them a lot of money to send to you through the same cable. So increasingly, people are canceling their actual cable TV service, keeping the broadband, the coax, and watching their shows for free online, some through Hulu and some through in other ways. And that cuts out a very profitable revenue stream for the cable companies. It's like an autoimmune disease. They're being attacked by their own cable. They're being, they're being shot with their own gun. I don't know what metaphor you want to use, but it's going to be pretty ruinous because, you know, while they make pretty good money selling broadband, that's only a portion of their revenue. A lot of it comes from the cable TV service that they so gouge you on, and day by day they lose more and more of those customers to things like Hulu and other manifestations of over the top. Sorry, Comcast. Breaks my heart.
Not really. Let's go next to Curtis in Arlington. Hey, Curtis.
Hi. Thanks, as always, for the show and for taking my call.
Sure. Welcome.
I wanted to drag out the comparison to public radio's business model again. Like Chris was saying earlier, the vast majority of listeners find the service worth using, but ostensibly aren't willing to pay for it, much like the Internet. But a small percentage of, you know, loyal listeners decide that they want to chip in, throw some money in the hat to keep the service available for everyone. And it seems almost absurd that a quality service could survive for that long on the spontaneous altruism of a small percentage of strangers. But as you point out, the only reason that that's really faltering now is because the distribution mechanism is becoming less relevant. As far as the business model is concerned, that's exactly how Wikipedia conducts itself. So how widely applicable do you think that structure could be on the Internet?
Well, two things. One, it is altruism, but it's not spontaneous. I mean, we beg, we guilt you, and we do it, you know, several times a year. So for some people, it's spontaneous and habitual, but for others, you know, they have to be kneecapped by our pledge drives, you know, three or four times a year. Well, I think one of the solutions for major newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post will be, you know, some sort of combination of foundation funding and advertising and the very sort of NPR altruism model that you've just described. The problem is there is a limited pool of altruistic dollars out there. And most likely every dollar that is paid to, let's say, some future not-for-profit New York Times is probably going to be robbed from NPR. So, you know, maybe the overall pool will grow somewhat as people become to realize that if they don't pony up, they're not going to get anything. But I don't think it's going to, you know, it's not going to increase a hundredfold, which means that it is not the solution to the future supply of good journalism, but it is, you know, one part of a potential solution.
So what do you imagine is the future of content? Should we be bracing ourselves for a sort of an unlimited flood of mediocrity?
Well, we have that already. And by the way, you don't have to go to YouTube to find it. You know, you can pretty much find it on NBC on any given night. I mean, mediocrity in and of itself is is nothing new. We're kind of accustomed to glitzy, high production value mediocrity, but, you know. Anyway, I digress. Yeah, I mean, the good news is there is a genuinely and bottomless reservoir of content out there, and much of it is so fantastic. You know, but it's 1%, less than 1%, 0.1% of the total pool of stuff out there that's worth looking at, which is why we're so dependent on our friends who are sort of volunteer deputy aggregators who pass on stuff to us that they like and we trust their opinion. So we look at it. That's how viral things go viral. There are aggregators who do it for us, like Google News, that scours the internets and comes up with what it deems to be the most relevant stuff. There's a lot of fantastic aggregators out there. FARC.com is just delicious along those lines. So we'll be depending more and more on them. And some tiny, tiny percentage of people who are discovered, whose great work does bubble to the surface, will find an ongoing business, but not along the mega profitable lines that, you know, Hollywood has enjoyed for the last century and a half. So I guess, no, not century and a half, century. So some stuff will bubble up and really be big. We'll get used to aggregating and virality to keep us going until things kind of sort themselves out in 10 or 20 years. I don't know how long it's going to take. But get used to this period of chaos when the content that we've so depended on, just, you know, much of it just simply goes away.
Where do you get your cable now?
I'm a Comcast.
Bob Garfield.
Yeah, I got to tell you, Chris, I have the most delicious cable service in the world. When when I call in with a problem, 12 trucks circle the neighborhood.
Bob Garfield is a media critic and co-host of NPR's On the Media. His new book is called The Chaos Scenario. Amid the ruins of mass media, the choice for business is stark. Listen or perish. Bob, it's been a genuine pleasure. Thank you so much.
Pleasure's mine. Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.